Well, David is a complex man, which is kind of a nice way of saying that is upright and is God-fearing and is determined to be obedient to the Lord as he is. He can also be proud and self-promoting and tend to overreact just a tad. And at times he would let his volcanic anger and his passions overwhelm even his best of intentions. Thus, when we concluded our previous lesson, David was in the throes of being consumed by his blind rage, the result of an insult aimed at him by a man known as Nabal. Now, Nabal was not actually the man's given name. The Bible doesn't tell us what his real name is. Rather, Nabal is an epithet that sums up this man's character: foolish, disgraceful, without godly wisdom. David and his men had guarded over Nabal's substantial flocks out in the Paran and the Maon desert regions. So David felt that it was only proper that Nabal reward him with a gift of sustenance for his community of what's now 600 followers. Thus a message was sent with a minyan of his men, 10 men, asking Nabal for this expected reward. Now, Nabal not only declined, but he responded in a nasty and an offensive way that just isn't done in the Middle East, well, unless you're looking for trouble. In reality, although David's request was made in the most polite of terms, all involved understood it was a demand. This is an offer you cannot refuse. A request that can't be refused isn't a request. And Nabal, being a rich and a very powerful and arrogant man, he didn't like David essentially requisitioning supplies from him. When David received Nabal's offensive reply, he took two-thirds of his men and he set off to exact revenge for this attack on his honor. It was his stated intention not to leave one male left alive in Nabal's extended family that no doubt included a goodly portion of his entire clan. Fortunately for all concerned, Nabal had a wife who was full of grace and wisdom. Her name was Abigail. And a man who had witnessed Nabal's offensive reply to David's message secretly went to Abigail and he told her about it, and pled with her to take some action to avoid this inevitable bloodshed that this was bound to result in. Well, she sprang into action. She loaded up a donkey with a substantial gift of supplies in hopes of appeasing David, all the while making sure her husband wasn't aware of this. That's where we're going to pick up this week. So open up your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 25. We're going to start reading at verse 18. Verse 18, if you have a complete Jewish Bible, it is page 327. Abigail wasted no time in taking 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already prepared, 6 quarts of roasted grain, 100 clusters of raisins, and 200 fig cakes, and then having them loaded onto donkeys. Then she said to her young men, "Go on ahead of me, I'll come along after you." But she didn't tell her husband at all. She was riding her donkey down past the hiding place in the mountains when David and his men descended towards her and she met them. And David had said, "What a waste it's been guarding everything this fellow has in the desert, so that nothing of his was missing, and he's repaid me now bad for good." And then he swore, "May God do the same and more to David's enemies if I leave even one male of everything he owns." And when Abigail saw David, she hurried to dismount from her donkey. She fell on her face in front of David, bowed down to the ground. And having fallen at his feet, she said, "It's all my fault, my lord, my fault. Please, let your servant speak in your ears and listen to what your servant says. Please, my lord shouldn't pay any attention to this worthless fellow Nabal, because he's just like his name. Nabal means boor, and his boorishness stays with him. But I, your servant, did not see my Lord's men whom you sent. Therefore, my Lord, as Adonai lives and as you live, and as much as Adonai has kept you from the guilt of shedding blood and from taking vengeance into your own hands, therefore may your enemies and anyone seeking your harm be as worthless as Nabal. Meanwhile, let this present which your servant has brought to my Lord be given to the men in my Lord's service, and please forgive the offense your servant has caused, because Adonai will certainly establish my Lord's dynasty. For my Lord fights Adonai's battles, and nothing bad has been found in all your life long. Even if someone comes along searching for you, seeking your life will be bound in the bundle of life with Adonai your God. But the lives of your enemies he'll fling away as if from the pouch of a slingshot. Then when Adonai had done all the good to my Lord that he has said about you and made you ruler over Israel, what happens here will not have become an obstacle to you. It won't be cause for remorse to my Lord, neither that you shed blood without cause, nor that my Lord took vengeance into his own hands. Finally, when Adonai has dealt with my Lord, then remember your servant. And David said to Abigail, blessed be Adonai, the God of Israel, who sent you today to meet me. And blessed be your tactfulness. Blessed be yourself for having kept me today from the guilt of shedding blood and taking vengeance into my own hands. For as Adonai, the God of Israel, lives, who has kept me from harming you, you hadn't rushed to meet me. Not even one male would have been left in Nabal by morning. So David received from her what she had brought him, and then said to her, go up in peace to your home. I've listened to what you said and granted your request. Abigail came to Nabal, and there he was in his house, holding a feast fit for a king. He was in high spirits because he was very drunk. So she told him nothing whatever until the next morning. And in the morning, when he was sober and his wife told him what had happened, he had a stroke. He became as motionless as a stone. And some 10 days later, Adonai struck Nabal and he died. And when David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, blessed be Adonai for having taken my side in the matter of Nabal's insult and for having prevented his servant from doing anything bad. On the contrary, Adonai has caused Nabal's bad deeds to return upon his own head. And then David sent a message that he wanted to make Abigail his own wife. And when David's servants reached Abigail in Carmel, they said to her, David has sent us to bring you to him to be his wife. She got up, bowed with her face to the ground, and said, your servant is here to serve you, to wash the feet of my Lord's servants. Abigail then hurried and set out and rode off on a donkey with 5 of her female servants following her. She went after David's messengers, and she became his wife. And David also took Ahinoam of Yisrael. Both of them became his wives. And meanwhile, Shaul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who came from Galim. Verse 20 explains that as David and his men were coming to make war on Nabal, it just so happened that the very route Abigail had taken to try and intercept David led her right to him. Now, the complete Jewish Bible doesn't express this thought of amazing coincidence very well. A better way for the verse to read is right at that moment, when she was riding her donkey in search of David, she comes across this band of men. So the idea is nothing happens, nothing by chance. It was Jehovah, it was his providence that set her path. And the exact time. He set it all in motion for this unlikely but urgent meeting to take place. The future Hebrew sages took this improbable timing of Abigail's encounter with David, along with some pronouncements she would make in this speech to him, to indicate that she was substantially more than merely a woman full of wisdom. Rather, she was a prophetess of the God of Israel. In fact, the Hebrew sages of old determined the Bible is 7 prophetesses, female prophets, with Abigail among them. They were Sarah, Abraham's wife, as the first, Then Miriam, Deborah, Hannah, Abigail, Huldah, and then the stunning Esther, who, of course, even has a Bible book named after her. Well, days and days have gone by since David and his band strapped on their weapons, left their desert accommodations for this showdown in Carmel. Now, verse 21 has David essentially muttering to himself as he's traveling, complaining about he and his men guarded this man's property. Oh, they've done such a good job, and this man repays their efforts with an insult. And truly, that's the mental picture we need to get. A very upset David who feels that he's been cheated. A man who's roiling this over in his mind, replaying his anger again and again. A modern psychologist might say he's playing those negative tapes in his head. Won't turn them off. And truly, just as for us in our time, this was David kind of enjoying being mad. He wasn't all that anxious to let it go, to move on. Folks, this is sin. This is sin that's being displayed here by David. It was so then, it remains so today. In fact, verse 22 continues with David's hissy fit. But most Bible versions, they clean it up substantially. The King James Version actually is the most literal, and it's the very best translated, word for word, from the Hebrew. And let me tell you, it's not just a little bit crude. It says in 1 Samuel 25:22, "So, and more also God do unto the enemies of David, if I leave of all that pertain to him by the morning light any that pisseth against a wall." Now, you heard that. I'm not making that up. That's there. And it means exactly what it says. I don't think I need to draw a diagram. Although I got a nice picture. Gary, you want to? No, okay. I don't need to explain to you what those last five or six words are getting at. So most Bible versions substitute for those last several words with the word male or men. Hello. The Bible, you see, doesn't mince words. And the reality is that so much of what we read today in our English translations has been watered down. It's made much more genteel, often less memorable, less impactful than what the words actually say. The predecessor to Messiah, David, is this strange mixture of stalwart shepherd and ferocious warrior. His thoughts are being accurately recorded for us here. And you know something? They're not very admirable right now. And here this mixture of shepherd and warrior seems utterly incompatible in one person, almost schizophrenic. A stalwart shepherd and a ferocious warrior. That's our Messiah. And yet Christianity in general has decided to emphasize one of those attributes over the other, even to discard one over the other. Partly, I'm sure, because it's so difficult to imagine any human or divine being that can be both at the same time. See, Judaism tends to discount David's human faults and his evil inclination and puts him on a pedestal of almost near perfection. He is made to be far closer to the actual Messiah than it was intended. And that is at least partly to blame for the spiritual blindness that's kept the Jewish people from intimacy with their true Messiah, Yeshua of Nazareth. On the other hand, I cannot begin to explain the countless conversations that I have had with Christian pastors and Christian laymen, who at the same time acknowledging that David is a type and an illustration of Messiah, yet also see Jesus as only a meek, pacifist shepherd who lovingly gave his life for our sakes. They see the God who orders war and bloodshed for the sake of establishing his kingdom and eradicating evil as a thing of the past. War is a chief characteristic of the Old Testament God. And shouldn't we all be glad that our New Testament God, Yeshua, has essentially replaced that older God, Jehovah's methods, with mercy and love? I often receive either startled looks or pretty blank faces when I ask these pastors and these same lay people to explain who it is then that is going to be leading the war to end all wars at Armageddon, who will personally cause the blood of God's enemies to fill the Jezreel Valley to the height of a horse's bridle. The answer is, of course, Jesus Christ. The same one who gently led 12 and then thousands and millions to redemption as a shepherd, only to be led himself as a lamb to the slaughter. Like David, our Messiah is a shepherd and a warrior. And I don't think it's long coming till we're going to be reminded of that. Poor David, however, was not Messiah. He was not God. So he struggled with these contrasting personal attributes. Shepherd and warrior that powerfully tugged on him one way, then the other. And he was on the road to Carmel. And as he was, the warrior had total control over him right now. And as a result, what lay ahead of him was his ruin. Enter Abigail. Now, Abigail dismounts from her donkey. She prostrates herself before David. Now remember now, this woman was an aristocrat. She was the attractive and intelligent wife of a wealthy, powerful man. But her station of life was of little importance to her at the moment. Her desperate hope was to stop an atrocity before it happened, to save her family and to save her clan, even if it meant her personal humiliation and her accepting all the blame. She was taking a pretty great risk. Abigail makes this long speech to David. He listens intently, probably because of the surprise of finding this well-heeled woman lying on her face on this dusty road. She tries to bring David back to his senses, to make him more amiable, to make him a little more peaceful, by offering three lines of reasoning for him to consider. And then hopefully drawing the conclusion that he needs to back off of his intentions. The first line of reasoning is that God is obviously present in this event because of the providential meeting of Abigail and David. The Lord has intervened. He has enabled Abigail's and David's paths to cross before he got to Nabal. Thus, David has been miraculously kept from murder, from incurring blood guilt as a consequence. The second line of reasoning is that it is Jehovah who is the avenger of wickedness and wrongdoing. David shouldn't try to be his own avenger, seeking out a solution to his own vengeance. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. This is at the heart of her argument that in verse 26, she says, may your enemies who seek evil for my Lord be like Nabal. In other words, may those who are David's enemies have vengeance heaped upon them by the Lord, who will turn them into fools for their wickedness. Third is that if David forgives this offense, then the Lord will give David a blessing in return. Because that's God's nature. In fact, Abigail generally lays out exactly what this blessing, the bercha, from Yehovah is going to consist of. First, the Lord will make David a lasting house. His family will be the ruling dynasty over Israel forever. Second, David will be privileged to continue to fight the Lord's battles, the Lord's wars. In other words, the wars David is fighting are authorized holy wars. Not only are they truly worthy of fighting, but you know what else it means? David can't lose. What a deal. It's a stacked deck. Third, God will preserve David from his own wrongdoing all of his days. In fact, this point is what most of this entire chapter is about. The Lord saving David from himself. No man will be able to take David's soul and destroy it because he will be safely bound up into what it calls here the bundle of life. Let's talk about that for a second. The bundle of life. Verse 29, the Complete Jewish Bible and many other translations speak of David being bound into the bundle of life. And this is generally pretty literal. She is saying that David's life will be bound up into this bundle of life. Life in Hebrew is chaim. Chaim. But here the word referring to David's life is nefesh. That doesn't mean life. It means your life essence. It's the word typically used and translated into English as soul or spirit. So it is David's soul. It's his life essence that's going to be bound up in this bundle of life. But bundle of life is actually an ancient Hebrew expression that we're running into. So we need to see if we can understand what it meant to people of that day to be bound up in the bundle of life. The Hebrew expression is Bisror Ha'ayim. And it is indeed speaking some kind of bundle and of life, but the bundle isn't referring to a bag or to a package. It's referring to a document. In the days of David, a document for the Hebrews was a scroll, or even better, it was an animal skin with words written on it. And then it got rolled up and tied usually with a piece of leather to form a bundle. Thus, a better and more apt translation is document of life or document of the living. So the bundle of life is some kind of a heavenly document, so to speak, where those whom the Lord chooses have their names placed into it. So their life essences, their souls, can be tucked away safely forever. Does that sound a little bit familiar? Obviously, this is the very early way of the Old Testament speaking of the heavenly book of life. Revelation 20:12. And I saw the dead, both great and small, standing in front of the throne. Books were opened. Another book was opened, the book of life. And the dead were judged from what was written in the books according to what they had done. The dead were written in the book of life according to what? According to what? What they had done. This matches very well with Abigail telling David that by his action of forgiving the insult, his action of changing his mind, and his action of not murdering, then he'd be written into the book of life. So as we've discovered, the many principles, such as the eternal life and the book of life, that we find in the New Testament are but progressive developments of principles already established, even if only vaguely, in the Tanakh, the Old Testament. Now, several times, as in verse 28, Abigail asks David to forgive her offenses. On the surface, this might seem as though she's essentially asking for forgiveness on behalf of her husband, or in a roundabout way, I suppose it is. But that's not really the point of it. Putting ourselves into a Middle Eastern mindset, we have to see that we have a woman speaking to a man who's not her husband. A man who was well known, and to a degree he's feared. She's dared to approach this man, even seeking him out, when usually a man must approach the woman if there's to be a conversation, especially one of this length and subject. She is boldly intervening in her husband's affairs. And it could have easily been David's decision to treat her badly for daring to stand between two men in conflict. In fact, she is coming dangerously close to, if not stepping over the line, of a somewhat obscure Torah law that we looked into a very long time ago. In Deuteronomy 25, verses 11 and 12, it says, if men are fighting each other and the wife of one comes up to help her husband get away from the man by grabbing the attacker's private parts with her hand, cut off her hand. Show her no pity. Certainly, Abigail is not physically tussling with David. Nonetheless, the underlying principle of Deuteronomy 25 stands. A woman was not to intervene in an otherwise fair fight between her husband and another man. This could have taken a number of different courses for Abigail, most of them pretty bad. And thus, her pleading with David to be forgiving towards her intervention in this matter. And in verse 30, we have Abigail truly now apprehending the role of a prophetess, even though there's no evidence that she saw herself in that kind of a role. There she looks forward to the time when God will have fulfilled his covenant promises to David in relation to David and the throne of Israel. She uses a word that we've become familiar with now. Nagid. Abigail speaks of David as a prince over Israel, a Nagid over Israel. And this term essentially means king in waiting. In other words, as the Lord has anointed him as the king in waiting, but he's not yet king, then he stands in constant danger now of stumbling. The danger for David is never more imminent now that he's been divinely appointed for great things by the Lord, because there are actions David can do to ruin his witness, ruin it, perhaps even his opportunity to be a wonderful tool in the Lord's hands. And Abigail continues. The thing that David is on his way to accomplish is to shed blood in vain, to commit blood guilt. To commit blood guilt means to take human life unjustly. Now, here's the thing about blood guilt. There is no atonement possible for it under the Levitical system. There is no sacrifice available. The only just outcome for the perpetrator of blood guilt is to have one's own life's blood spilled. No innocent animal losing its life. No priestly ritual could be done before the Lord as a substitute for it. If David does this thing, he's committed a grave trespass for which there is no forgiveness. And there is yet another danger that Abigail says that David is in. It is that he might seek to gain the Lord's victory for himself. In other words, just as David has made it clear that he knows he's not to win the throne of Israel by his own actions, such as murdering King Saul, neither is he to avenge wrongs done to him by means of his own actions, such as killing Naval and all of Naval's family. She ends her speech by asking David to remember her in the future for what she has done today. And Abigail recognized the father's guiding hand in David's life, and that his destiny was as Israel's king. How did she know this? That's why she's counted as among only seven prophetesses. Such understanding can only have come from God. It wasn't known. But she did more than merely recognize David's destiny. She took an active role to preserve it, even if it meant risking her life. I think that we need to consider not only the blessing that we have gained from our acceptance of God's covenant provision for us as believers, but also now, and hear me on this, the danger that we're now in at all times because we have made a commitment to Him. The devil doesn't waste his time with unbelievers. Just he uses them as pawns to do his dirty work. That's all he does. Rather, his main efforts are always to confound the lives of the disciples of Yeshua, to derail the wonderful purposes that the Father has for our lives, especially as it pertains to the kingdom of God. You know, I shudder at how close we must come often to disaster, and we don't even recognize it. I mean, I look back at my own life, and as thankful as I am for what the Lord mercifully choosing to use me for His purposes is, I'm also at least somewhat aware that had I been more obedient, more faithful, I would have been a lot better witness, much better teacher, better family man, much more useful servant for Him. I mean, what opportunities I have lost from my sin, and what could have been greater gain for the kingdom, I'll never know this side of heaven. And as great as David was, I suspect that as the end of his life neared, he looked back. Many regrets. A lot of realization that so much more could have been accomplished through him if only he had been more submissive to God. And beginning in verse 32, David now responds to Abigail, and what can only be described as a startling act of humility of a Middle Eastern man towards a woman, David agrees that Abigail's entirely correct, and he's entirely wrong. Not only does David forgive her for her bold intervention between he and Nabal, but he bestows compliments and blessings and admits that she is an emissary of the God of Israel, at least in this case. And had she not been obedient to the Lord, had she allowed her fear to take over, and she shrank from her divine assignment, not only would her family be gone, but David would have become mired in blood guilt, from which there was no escape. David recognized that as much as she saved her family, she has saved him. You know, when he has done wrong, or is contemplating wrong, and confronted with it, he is contrite. He admits his guilt before God. He acknowledges that even above those he's harmed, it's God who he has sinned against. See, a contrite heart is the key to true repentance. David accepts the supplies she brought, then commands Abigail to go home in peace. In other words, he says, I won't attack your home, won't attack your family, won't even attack that dastardly husband of yours. And when Abigail arrives back home, Nabal has no idea what she's been up to and how close he's come to losing his life. Nor does he have any idea that it was his wife who just delivered his entire clan from certain eradication. He was drunk. He was drunk when she got home. So she thought, I'm not going to inform him now what's transpired. And in the morning after he'd sobered up, Abigail told him what had occurred. And almost immediately, he had a stroke. And within 10 days, he died. Abigail was right. The Lord will avenge. The insolent, the worthless Nabal was struck down by Jehovah, not by David. The Lord taking Nabal's life was the Lord exacting perfect justice on David's behalf. David taking Nabal's life would have been unjust. It would have been an unforgivable sin on David's head. I mean, a great lesson for all of us when we contemplate taking matters into our own hands. I mentioned last week that there's often significance of numbers in the Bible, and 10 is one of those more significant numbers. Notice that Nabal died 10 days after he received the message of God's deliverance of his family, which was the same number as the number of men who came to Nabal with David's message. 10 is a number of fullness in the sense that something's been brought to its fullest extent. 10 is a number of perfect completeness, not a perfect ending, but rather something that's been made all it was purposed to be. 10 is a number of divine order as opposed to earthly chaos. Thus, also, the proper measure of the giving of our wealth back to the Lord is said to be 1/10. Amazing how that plays together. Now, evidence is gathering in modern physics that there are 10 dimensions of existence. Jewish mysticism has for 500 years made the claim that the Bible describes 10 dimensions of existence. So when we come across the number 10 in the Bible, always pay special attention to it, just like we do when we see the number 7. Well, this chapter ends with David asking Abigail, who's now Nabal's widow, to be his wife. And David sends messengers to her, and her response is quite interesting. And she says in verse 41, she got up and bowed with her face to the ground and said, your servant is here to serve you, to wash the feet of my Lord's servants. Now, this remark is significant, especially when we incorporate the concept that David is a type and a shadow of Messiah. Note that Abigail speaks not of her washing David's feet, but rather the feet of David's followers, David's servants. And since she has accepted David's offer of marriage in front of witnesses, she's now legally betrothed. She's engaged. She is David's wife, the master's wife, with only the act of consummation left to finalize this marriage. And yet she speaks of herself as a servant who wants to wash the feet of her husband's servants. Now, does that have a familiar ring to it? Open your Bibles to the New Testament, John chapter 13. John chapter 13. You have a complete Jewish Bible. It's page 1348. We're going to read the first 20 verses of John chapter 13. It was just before the festival of Pesach, Passover. And Yeshua knew that the time had come for him to pass from this world to the Father. And having loved his own people in the world, he loved them to the end. They were at supper, and the adversary had already put the desire to betray him into the heart of Yehuda ben Shimon from Kriot. Now Yeshua was aware that the Father had put everything in his power, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he rose from the table, he removed his outer garments, and he wrapped a towel around his waist. And then he poured water into a basin, and he began to wash the feet of the Talmidim, his disciples, and wipe them off with the towel that was wrapped around him. Well, he came to Shimon Kepha, Simon Peter, who said to him, Lord, you're washing my feet? And Yeshua answered him, you don't understand yet what I'm doing, but in time you'll understand. No, said Kepha, you'll never wash my feet. And Yeshua answered him, if I don't wash you, you'll have no share with me. Lord, Shimon Kepha replied, then wash not only my feet, but my hands and head too. And Yeshua said to him, a man who has had a bath doesn't need to wash except his feet. His body is already clean. And you people are clean, but not all of you. He knew who was betraying him, which is why he said, not all of you are clean. And after he had washed their feet, taken back his clothes and returned to the table, he said to them, do you understand what I've done to you? You call me Rabbi, Lord, and you're right, because I am. Now, if I, the Lord and the Rabbi, have washed your feet, you should also wash each other's feet. For I have set you an example so that you may do as I have done to you. Yes, indeed, I tell you, a slave is not greater than his master, nor is an emissary greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. I'm not talking to all of you. I know which ones I've chosen. But the words of the Tanakh, the Old Testament, must be fulfilled that say, the one eating my bread has turned against me. I'm telling you now before it happens so that when it does happen, you may believe that I am. Yes, indeed, I tell you that a person who receives someone I send receives me, and that anyone who receives me receives the one who sent me. Truly, the Hebrew sages of old were right to assign Abigail the title of God's prophetess. This foot-washing episode just comes out of left field in the book of Samuel, and one finds it difficult in discerning its meaning and its purpose. Why is that even here? But if we know the New Testament, now it makes sense. And truly, David was a wise man to immediately go after such a woman when she became a widow, God's hand. Yet we also find that David married not only Abigail, but a woman from the city of Jezreel, whose name was Ahinoam, means my brother is delight. Jezreel is not the Jezreel Valley in the north of the land, but rather a place in Judah in the general vicinity of Maon and Ziph and Carmel. Saul had a wife named Ahinoam, and some think this was the same woman, but that's a little bit far-fetched. There's no evidence whatsoever to consider that kind of a conclusion. Now, most likely, David married Ahinoam before marrying Abigail, because Ahinoam became mother of David's firstborn, Amnon. Even more in later books of the Bible, when the two women are mentioned in the same context, Ahinoam is always mentioned before Abigail. Now, this is just an ancient literary form, and it describes status. Now, no doubt, there was also politics at play in these marriages. David married prominent women from two different clans located in two different regions in Judah. Marrying into these families would have given David a foothold as a future ruler and would have gained him the backing of those two clans. See, marriage is a means of gaining allies was standard procedure in those days. It wasn't considered underhanded at all. Rather, it was practical and customary. Families were anxious and willing for this kind of intermingling in connections with the ruling elite. Now, the final verse of this chapter explains that Saul willfully and spitefully gave his daughter, David's wife, Michal, to another man. This reckless act ended all possibility now of reconciliation between David and Saul. The man she was given to is known by two names in the Bible, Falti and Falti-El. By Torah law standards, Michal was forced into adultery because her husband David had not divorced her. Falti-El was also guilty of taking the wife of another man. Adultery was another trespass that has no atonement possible. So the crime before the Lord was severe, it was unforgivable, and it was eternal. Yet because David had not divorced Michal, he had every right to ask for her to be returned to him as he was negotiating with Abner on his way to becoming king of Israel. And in taking her back, he was committing no crime. He was simply restoring her. So we'll begin chapter 26 next time and continue this story.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seed of Abraham Fellowship.